The Helly Catherine Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HellyKetherJane.com.
Something else struck me. Your life and your brother's life got caught up in the life and the death and the victimization of Nicole Simpson. Not just Ron being a victim of the judicial system that in the criminal trial failed to serve, and a relentless press victimized you as well. I mean, you have been victimized, baby, from every angle that I could possibly think of. I'm going back and I'm reading this and I'm going, what in the heck? I mean, I have to tell you this. Better people than you would have taken to the bed with Oreo cookies, and that's where they'd spend the rest of their life.
So, you know, it's funny. I always said that I wish I would have had advice, because I think it sometimes it would have helped. But I faced everything head on. Like and this is a horrible thing to say, but a part of me wishes that I just would have checked out sometimes. I just wish I would have, you know, turned to gambling or turned to something that I shouldn't have been doing just so I could take. I mean, I'm not that girl, and that's not part of my makeup.
Cookies and taking to the bed? No, neither are a part of Kim Goldman's makeup. Say what you will about Kim Goldman and her father, Fred, and many have plenty to say, not always nice. They became unwitting victims when brother and son, Ron Goldman, along with O.J. Simpson's wife, Nicole, were murdered in cold blood by Simpson, at least according to the verdict of the civil trial. Yes, Kim Goldman has chutzpah and more, as you were about to learn today, when Kim joins me at my table on the Helly Catherine Show. Hi, and welcome. Thank you so much for being here. I am your host, Helly Catherine. But before we begin today, the Helly Catherine Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HallieKesserJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And remember, the Helly Catherine Show is always available online at HallieKesserJane.com and a host of venues including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, the iHeartRadio Network, and on our home network on Blog Talk Radio. Don't tell Kim Goldman she needs to find closure. Don't ask her to forgive and forget. When Kim Goldman was just 22 years old, her older brother, Ron Goldman, was brutally murdered by unconvicted football legend and film star O.J. Simpson. Ron and Kim were extremely close, and her devastation was compounded by the shocking not guilty verdict in what was to be called the trial of the century. Now, 20 years later, Kim Goldman shares what she calls her 20-year battle with O.J. Simpson in her book, Can't Forgive. At the time of her brother's brutal murder, Kim was no stranger to trauma. Her parents divorced when she was young, and she and Ron were raised by their father. When she was 14, she was almost blinded from severe battery acid burns on her face during an automobile accident, requiring 3 reconstructive surgeries. Does one trauma prepare one? How to best handle another? Is there a time to put the past to bed? Counseled by friends, strangers, and even Oprah to find closure, Kim chose a different route. She chose to fight, and that fight would be the subject of tabloid fodder, now nearing a quarter of a century. That being said, ultimately, Kim Goldman's story is that of an ordinary person thrown into extraordinary circumstances at a very young age, a woman who had the courage, despite the discouragement of so many, to ignore the conventional wisdom and never give up her fight for justice. Closure? Who says? Let's talk. So, something, Kim, that I've wondered about, and that is, if you still dream about Ron, and if you do, it seems that the only way you could see him is as the 25-year young man he was who was brutally murdered June 12, 1994. Did some way life stop back then?
You know, it stalled, I would say. To answer your question about whether or not I still dream about him, you know, I don't know, honestly, anymore. I know that I've had some really vivid dreams in the past, but my sleep is all messed up, and, you know, I live a different life now, and I'm anxiety-ridden, and
you and
you know,
the rest
I don't,
of us.
I don't really know, actually. I have a hard time remembering some of my dreams. I wish I could. I wish I could get them analyzed because sometimes they're really chaotic. But my brother, his face doesn't normally come through in my dreams, but I think an essence of him perhaps does.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
I used to dream a lot about how I wanted to stop him from going to Nicole's, and I would run in front of him as he was walking down the sidewalk to her house, and I think some of that, it was just a little bit of survivor's guilt or feeling like I could have done something to stop him, but maybe because I've worked through some of those kinds of dreams don't come as much anymore. But yeah, I would say things have stalled. Girl interrupted,
yeah.
I say.
Yeah, girl interrupted. For 20 years, this case has remained tabloid fodder. It's unbelievable. Everyone has an opinion, you know that, whether he did it or he didn't, but I want to talk to you about you and Ron. I want to talk to that the two of you, as you tell in your wonderful book, Can't Forgive, how close you were and the reasons for the fact that you were so exceptionally close. So you didn't just lose a brother. You lost a best friend. And early on, things were hectic in your life. For all intent and purposes, you were abandoned by your mom.
Yep.
So talk to us about that.
Yes. You know, I think people are always surprised to hear, you know, at siblings and how close we were, because I think they envision siblings to just beat each other up all the time, which we did. But my brother and I formed a really incredibly strong bond from the time we were little, I think born out of some trauma that we had in our life from our mother leaving us when we were very young. You know, back in the 70s, it was kind of unheard of that a father would gain full custody of his kids, but that's what happened when my mother walked out. My brother and I were about 3.5 and 6, and she left. And my dad stayed and did what he is supposed to do as a parent and put the work in and sacrificed what he was, you know, wanting to and supposed to and gain custody of my brother and I, like I said. And, you know, Ron and I just always relied on each other because we knew we were each other's staple. You know, we were each other's foundation. And even though my dad created this incredible home for us, we knew subconsciously that the parents leave, that they leave you. And we just, I don't know. I don't know if it was ever spoken. I don't remember. We just always were together and we always looked out for each other. My brother was very much my protector. And it's not to say that my dad wasn't. My dad was amazing. But there was just something between Ron and I that just was amazing. And that's the best way that I can put it. You know, we had a car accident later in my life and my brother was the one that pulled me out of the car. And he was the one that was there for me when my heart was broken from a boy at school and, you know, would stick up for me on the playground if someone was pushing me around. And my brother was the one that let me tag behind him so that I wouldn't get left out. There was just
a really close bond between the two of you. And I think that's an important element to this because I think that, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on, that when people who are so cruel to victims, they're cruel. They missed a lot of it. And, you know, and I went back and looked at a lot of the story just to refresh my mind before you and I talked. And we're going to talk about that too, some of the things I discovered. But it's amazing how hard people are on the victims. And they just didn't understand that closeness that the two of you had and intimated that it was made up. And that just totally is crazy. I want to talk a little bit about your mom because I think it's going to come up a little bit later as we further this discussion. She kidnapped you. Your mommy kidnapped you.
Yeah. You know, again, going back, I kind of glossed over it a little bit, but the custody hearings and, you know, my brother and I went in and out of therapy and I'll never forget Betty Littleman. She was our therapist. And, you know, I remember during that time when my dad and Sharon were going to court, I remember telling the therapist, Betty, that I wanted to stay with my dad and my brother did too. As hard as it was, we knew inherently that we were better off with our father. And when right before my dad gained sole custody for us, Sharon took us one day and kept us from a Friday to a Monday. My dad had no idea where we were and she kept us hidden from him. And during that time, continued to tell my brother and I that my dad didn't love us, that he didn't want us, that we were too much trouble. I mean, it was always bad-mouthing my dad. And I remember the scene of my dad banging down the door to save us, essentially. And it was very traumatic. It's very traumatic to have a parent tell you that you're unloved as the same person that's treating you in such a horrible way, you know? And
then ultimately
she disappeared. And so the irony is obviously there, but...
Well, big abandonment issues, kiddo.
Yeah.
A theme of your life.
I didn't really realize how much I was dealing with all those abandonment stuff until I was, you know, my late 20s, early 30s. My dad had created such a home life for Ron and I that we always felt safe and protected and loved. I never really noticed any...
Right. But you know what that is.
Any holes.
Yeah.
And then when my brother died and Sharon came back into the picture and it just kind of brought up a lot of that, and it didn't really come to me until later in my life how abandoned I felt. myself.
Right. And abandonment, it's odd. For anybody who's experienced it, it's not like everything else. It's a very different thing. And when a mother abandons, I also think that is far more bizarre because there's no model for it in our culture.
And I will argue with any therapist that tries to tell me I can be cured of it. There's really no way to fully ever heal, you know, from that, because no matter how rational you are as an adult, there is still, and I write about it in the book too, that there's still a little girl in me that was like, how come she didn't pick me? Because again, you don't expect that a parent would leave you.
Right.
They're just not supposed to do that.
Exactly.
It goes against the natural order of things.
Absolutely. So, I get that. Yeah, totally. I want to go back to that car accident for a second because there's an aspect of it that I find just amazing. There was a terrible car accident. You suffered battery burns. You're so stunning. You always have been. From when you were that little girl in the trial, that young girl, that young woman. How old were you at the time of the trial? You were
22.
And adorable.
Yeah.
I mean, who would know that you had suffered these just massive burns? Talk about that briefly, but let me take it to this point, which is at the end of that conversation, we get to this, Kim. And this touched me a lot when I was reading the book, and that is the face that you feel you have. I know you had surgery, but you're stunning. That it's not the face that Ron knew.
So just to get back up a little bit, when I was 13, turning 14, my brother and my dad and my stepmom and I were in a horrible car accident in Florida. A drunk driver hit a tree, car flipped, battery from his car came through our car, blew up in my face, and I suffered first, second, and third degree battery acid burns on my neck, eyes, and face. As a result of that, I had, you know, a handful of plastic surgeries. I have a gigantic scar on my face. Other people say they don't notice it, but to me, it's very visible. But, you know, it changed me, and it wasn't the face I was born with. It's not the face that I feel like look like my brother every time someone would say, oh, you look just like your brother, because I feel like I'm deformed, you know?
Wow.
I mean, I have a big scar on my face, even though I get that other people don't see it. I do, because I know what I look like before. And, you know, it's hard because when I had growing up, people, oh, you and your brother look so much alike, and you always knew you were siblings. And then there's something shifted and my face looked different. And now that my brother's gone, I don't have anybody to say you look just like your brother. You know, there's like these weird little...
Yeah, no, there's psychological traumas and they all interweave in your life. And it's really stunning. And I think that's why I enjoyed this book so much, because you put it together in a way that we could understand stuff. You know, I gotta tell you, Kim, being on the outside, looking into the trauma of what happened with his killing, nobody can ever be in your shoes. Nobody. And we forget that because we all live on our own cocoons. But you have to start to look at other people's lives from their perspective and from their diary, not from ours. And I think that that's a very powerful thing that you said in that book. It certainly touched me.
Well, I think just to stay on that point for one second, part of the thing that I think was so difficult when my brother died is that my brother and I were just starting to kind of come into our own. And I think that was, you know, important for me to show in the book that, you know, we had suffered some traumas in our life, not any more different than anybody else's, but we had our own traumas and we were just kind of coming out of the clearing of that. And then my brother lost his life and what happened to our family. And I just, you know, when you ask me for my life change, it's stalled. Like, we just couldn't, you know, get it going. You know, we started feeling good about, you know, Sharon leaving, and then we get into an accident, and we start feeling good about that, and then my brother dies. It's just like there was just never, we never had a good stride. And
right.
I feel cheated in a way from that. But.
And understandably so. I think another aspect of it is the way that he went, the brutality of it, and I don't think anybody can take that in, and I'm sure you couldn't and probably still can't, but as much as the brutality was just hard to probably take in, he's here 1 minute and he's gone the next. And you had so much of your life, the power was taken away from you.
Yep.
And here it is again.
Yeah, and I, you know, and the difference being here is that in the other situations that had happened and the other traumas that my brother and I experienced, we had each other to lean on. And when my brother died, I didn't have him. I didn't have him to protect me and keep me safe and to tell me it was going to be okay. And I had my dad, but I lost a big part of my dad. And so the relationship that my brother and I had and then I lost really was exacerbated at that point because I didn't have him anymore to fix it.
Right.
You know, and to help me fix it. And we were each other's go-to in that regard. And that I never really understood, you know, I understood it, but it's like it really, you know, now as a grown woman, you know, I'm realizing the loss of a sibling and I don't have those relationships to carry into my adulthood. And, you know, with my father getting a little older, I get a little more nervous about being
alone.
And, you know, it's hard. It's grief. This is why I argue with people about the concept of closure, because it just doesn't exist. I stay with this my whole life.
We're going to talk about that later. later, so let's not get into that too much, except for me to say this to you. If life is a maze and we all have to wind our way through the maze of our existence, this is what I was thinking when I was reading your book, that, you know, when you're in a maze, you go down one place and you keep going, you think you're going to get to the end, to where the goal is, and then you hit a roadblock. And I don't care what you do, you cannot get past that. You have to go back, go around, circle, blah, blah, blah. That's your life. That's Kim's life. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's a perfect analogy for it.
It's a crazy thing. Something else struck me in being able to take the time and finally think this through, which I never have time in my own life until a story comes up and I got to read it for the show. And I was possessed with this when it was happening, like everybody else. Your life and your brother's life got caught up in the life and the death and the victimization of Nicole Simpson.
Uh-huh.
We tend to forget that this was a crime of passion, because it was. It was definitely that. I mean, it was a sick guy, right? And the Goldman family, not just Ron being a victim of the judicial system that in the criminal trial failed to serve, and a relentless press victimized you as well. I mean, you have been victimized, baby, from every angle that I could possibly think of. I'm going back and I'm reading this and I'm going, what in the heck? I mean, I have to tell you this. Better people than you would have taken to the bed with Oreo cookies, and that's where they'd spend the rest of their life.
So, you know, it's funny. I always said that I wish I would have had advice, because I think it sometimes it would have helped. But I faced everything head on. Like, and this is a horrible thing to say, but a part of me wishes that I just would have checked out sometimes. I just wish I would have, you know, turned to gambling or turned to something that I shouldn't have been doing just so I could take. I mean, I'm not that girl, and that's not part of my makeup, but I really just, no antidepressants, no anxiety pills. Like, I sat in it and I dealt with it and I faced it. And, you know, it's still hard. It's still hard to be in it, to be the recipient of it, to bear witness to it happening to other families. I still get people that email me and try to convince me that the killer isn't the killer and why I should be looking at a different person as the guilty person. I mean, I still get it. People still have very negative comments to say. In the same breath, I still get amazing support and love from people. But we were like the dumping ground for a lot of hate and judgment and criticism. And I think I even stated in the book, I think some of that just stemmed from being ill-informed. And people still don't understand what happened in the case. And they still think that my brother and Nicole were having an affair, and that's why he died. And I still get people that tell me my brother deserved to be killed because he was sleeping with somebody else's wife. People still don't get it. And there's really not a lot I can do except just take it on the chin.
So where does the strength come from?
My dad, my friends, myself, my brother, my son. And some days I just choose not to. Some days I just choose to be cranky and pissy and antisocial and don't want to deal and don't want to respond to people's emails. And sometimes I create alter egos and respond to those nasty comments and let people have it.
Hell, girl, I don't have a brother who was murdered. Yeah, and I hear you about that, but I don't have a brother who got killed. And I tell you what, I'm still with you on all of that. I get that. Totally get that.
Well, I think part of it, like I said, I have to understand that I lived it and I know information other people don't know, and I was in the brunt of it for such a long time. I can't expect everybody across the country to be as connected and committed and invested in it as I was. But that doesn't also mean that I have to
take it
either.
Right.
You know, I mean, some of the, you know, between death threats and stalking and just the nasty stuff that people put on the internet because they can hide behind a fake avatar or whatever it is and they can just spew their hate. They don't realize that it's damaging and it's hurtful, and even on my best days it still stings.
Yeah, no, I get that, but you know, we live in a crazy world. I mean, there's no question about it. People are nuts. You never say the name O.J. Simpson. To you, he's the killer, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Talk about that decision not to refer to him by name. And in the same vein, although your mom abandoned her parenting responsibilities of you guys, most of your childhood you called her mom. It was only later that you elected to call her by her given name, Sharon. What's in a name?
Well, with Sharon, actually, it was earlier than, it was right around when I was about 7 that when I knew she kind of wasn't coming back for us, that my brother and I just asked our dad if it would be okay if we called her mom. I mean, called her Sharon, because we didn't feel like she was much of a mom to us. So that was pretty early. Great. She was gone my whole life. So, you know, she's just Sharon, because I don't think she earned the right to be called mom. She didn't.
Right.
She birthed me. That's pretty much it.
Right.
So when it comes to the killer, I feel like, Dominic Dunn, who most people know Dominic from a writer for Vanity Fair, but his daughter was also killed. She was one of the actresses in Poltergeist, and Dominic was a big victims' rights advocate, and we became very close during the trial. And Dominic and I were sitting around one day, and something came up about the killer, and Dominic called him a killer, and we just said, that's what he is. That's what he is. I mean, and just from then on, it just, that's what he became. And I was frustrated with him, the killer, being referred to by his first name all the time, and people were so casual and so friendly, and they like high five him. And even news anchors, you know, when they would talk about the story, they would just talk about OJ. They weren't talking about his full name. It was too familiar, and it was too friendly, and it was too comfortable. And I didn't think that he deserved that level of intimacy. He's a killer, and that's
who he is.
I can say his name. People think that I never
say it right.
it's a choice. I mean, I certainly can say it, but I just opt not to.
I hear you. The Trial of the Century, another name. You're not too thrilled with that either. I don't blame you, because that just kind of, deludes the real truth of what all of this is about. Talk to me why you don't like it.
Well, I'm not a person that does well when you categorize things and everything has to have a title. And I feel like, you know, the Trial of the Century has to come with a theme song. Like, I just feel like it diminishes what happened, you know, and what I learned going through my brother's and Nicole's murder trial, that it really was never about Ron and Nicole. And when you called it the Trial of the Century, it just became something bigger than what these two small families were dealing with. And that was a tremendous amount of pain and sorrow and anguish and trauma. And putting the Trial of the Century, you know, just like neon lights, I just felt like it just became this circus, you know, this dramatic production every day. And it was, but I just was, I was 22 years old, and I'm thinking, my brother died. Why are you all calling it the Trial of the Century? I just didn't get it.
And I get that you didn't get it. It was such theater. It became theater.
Yeah.
It became the circus that you referred to. You know, it's funny, very quickly, you don't even have to respond. This is just something that I picked up. You know, you say the name Judge Ito or Marcia Clark or Chris Darden or Tom Lang or Mark Furman, Phil Vinatter. You know, my heart starts to beat. Does yours still?
Absolutely. I mean, it really, really puts me, and not that I need anything to put me back in those moments, but framed a big, huge part of my young adulthood. And I think our country, like, it really is like a marker place for people. Everybody knows those names. You know, short of up-and-coming kids, you know, that were like 4 or 5
right,
at the time,
right,
who actually still write me and say, I don't really remember much, but my parents used to watch the trial, and I'm studying about this now in my law class, or whatever it might be. But people, Cato Kalin, you know, they remember Cochran. I mean, everyone, oh, you doesn't fit, you must have. I mean, everybody knows.
Catchphrase.
You know, Bruno Mali shoes, they
right,
know what that, the glove, like, there's certain catchphrases, and it has become such a part of our
Mexican
vernacular now,
yeah,
that some of those phrases are even used as verbs. And that trips me out. Like, you know, you watch, and you alluded to it before, that it's everywhere. I mean, it's still on the nightly, you know, talk shows. You still hear comments. You still hear it in movies. My son, who's 11, now picks up on it in movies, whereas before he didn't always catch the references. But now he hears it. Even in new movies, it's referenced. New television shows, it's referenced. And it should be 20 years later. It's still
crazy. It's
pop
crazy
culture.
And you know what it is? It was the beginning of TMZ.
It was the beginning of, well, I know Harvey Levin, who was founder.
Well, I don't mean that literally,
reporter,
but I mean figuratively.
Then.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't mean it literally.
It was the onset of cable news and
yeah,
the 24-hour news cycle, and that started it for sure.
You know, I've had Gil Garcetti on the show. I'm a big fan of his photography. He's
yeah,
unbelievable. He's a cool guy. But he shuts down. You know, he's friend.
Yep.
I'm not talking about it, Hallie. I don't care how much I love you. We're not going down that road. But in this particular aspect, I had him on the show a couple of times, and one of the times we did a show on the death penalty, because, you know, he's a big proponent, too, in the death penalty. And I wondered where you are on that.
Definitely a proponent of the death penalty. However, only if we use it. I don't support putting people on death row and leaving them there for 25 years and wasting all of our taxpayer dollars to keep someone alive on death row. I think that is a complete waste, and I don't think it's a deterrent the way that it was set up to be. When you give someone, you know, the death penalty, you're going to execute them, but then you let them sit for 25 years. I don't get it. I was a psych major. I went to school for psychology. I was of the mindset that everybody needed a chance to be rehabilitated, and everybody just needs second chance. Well, I'll tell you, the second my brother died, I did not afford that to anybody anymore when it comes to this kind of a crime. I don't think that if you commit a heinous crime and are found guilty that you need to be wasting any more of our time and effort. And I just don't have any sympathy for it. And I know that makes me sound cold and callous, but...
No, it's how you feel.
But I understand. Listen, it's a very hot topic. It's widely... I get it. I just don't have to. And I think that's where when I think about my brother's case, I'm very logical. I'm very realistic when it comes to most things. I can think it through. My father and I are polar opposites on so many points of view. But when it comes to my brother's case, I reserve the right to be illogical and emotional and irrational and inconsistent with some of my views as it relates to other cases. And I'm just going to stick to that.
I get that thoroughly and totally. You know, God bless. I mean, go for
it. That's my prerogative.
Yeah, I think you earned that prerogative, by the way, the hard way. On the same score of hot button issues, this was a race case. It didn't start out as a race case, but it wound up being a race case. And he was let off, a lot of people think, race. And here we are today, Ferguson, Trayvon Martin. Where are you on that? You've been called a race, what?
Racist.
Thank you.
I've been called a lot of things. I never understood, you know, here again, going back to putting myself in terms of my age, my dad raised my brother and I did not see things in terms of black and white or color, which I wrote in my book that I think was really naive, but it was not in a bad way. I mean, I just did not see things that way. And so everybody in my eyes was the same. So when race started to become an issue with my brother's case, I was so confused because what does that have to do with anything? Like, I didn't get it. Again, like, why?
Right.
What does that have to do with anything? What is that for a motive? I mean, I just, black guy killing two white people, the black guy lived a life as a white guy. Like, I couldn't, in my head, it never made sense to me. And it didn't make sense in terms of any kind of fact. There's no facts to prove that there was any racial issues going on here. It was just floated theory by a very smart defense team who saw in a set of jurors that would fall into that trap. And that's what happened. And they baited the jury with it, and the jury took it hook, line, and sinker. And there was never anything to show that there was any kind of racial issue. But what it did to our country and how it set back race relations in our country was deplorable. And I think Cochran was 100% to blame for that. And I still think that we're in a horrible state as it relates to race relations currently. I mean, it's bad. And now I'm very aware of it.
Oh, well, sure. And then you look at the judicial system. Right. And you say to yourself, what's going on here, folks? I mean, you know, every ploy that can be played for whatever reason it needs to be played. And that works on both sides, by the way.
Yeah.
Give or take. I don't think you're a big fan of the judicial system.
It's very sad to me when these other cases come out, you know, Trayvon Martin or Eric Garner or Michael Brown. And if I have an opinion that might be on the side of the law or the police, people call me a racist.
Oh, sure.
And I'm just mad because a black guy got off for killing my brother. And I'm thinking, I never even thought those two thoughts together. I'm just, again, looking at facts, looking at evidence, and trying to be logical and rational. And sometimes that doesn't jive with what public outcry is.
Right.
Sometimes it doesn't.
I get you. You know, I want to go back for 1 second because when I was doing the research on this thing, I stumble upon this headline. Victim thrived on life in fast lane, his friends recall. June 15th, 1994, 3 days after the murder. Matthew Musk and Carla Hall, bylines. This is so crazy. You mentioned it briefly before, but I wanted to just punctuate it because you guys really withstood some crap.
You know, like any case, because I'm very sensitive to it now, you're always going to have people that want to insert themselves as
LA Times,
a confidant,
by the way,
as a spokesperson, as a close family member, as a best friend, a girlfriend. We had lots of people that my brother's best friends that we never heard of. We had lots of people asserting themselves as, you know, the closest thing, you know, to a sister or brother that he ever had. We had lots of those people that popped up. And in those first stages, first couple of days, you know, we were confused by it. But then my father and I tried to fix some of that because the picture that they were painting of my brother was this partying,
right.
You know,
he was 25
like,
years old.
My brother wasn't a drinker. My brother wasn't a partier. Did he go to clubs and dance? Heck yeah. But my brother was into bodybuilding and health. Like, I went to his house, he had no food in his house. I mean, he was all organic crap. You know, nothing that my dad and I would eat, but my brother, he was into, you know, working out and being healthy and always on his bike and like being out in the sun. My brother never did drugs. Maybe he drank beer. So what?
I'm just telling you, just the whole thing is so crazy to me. But I think it's important to note it to the game that goes on in this whole world, this whole crazy thing.
To talk about people that showed up out of nowhere, my birth mom popped up and talked about this secret relationship that she'd been having with my brother for 20 years and how close they were. And she and Ron were the only ones that knew they were having this whole separate mother and son thing. I'm thinking, what?
Where did this come from? I mean, you know, right. No, I hear you. I mean, it's also crazy. I mean, it's a wonder. I'm telling you, give me that Oreo cookie. Your dad's mustache was even part of this. Tim. And your dad, that's a sad story. I mean, tell us about how it's a great mustache. Most men would kill to have that mustache.
My poor dad. My dad has the Raleigh finger mustache, which everybody knows. And my dad, a lot of people would accuse my dad, you know, of just, why don't you just shave it? Then people won't recognize you. And that's why people know my dad is because of the mustache. But, you know, years after we moved to California from Chicago, my dad took my brother and I in a car ride down to the beach and told us a story about years ago. He had suffered cancer treatments or gone through some cancer treatments and lost a lot of his hair and his facial hair and notably his mustache. And it reminded me of a memory that I had when I was younger, that my dad came to give me a kiss and I pushed him away because I didn't recognize him. And I thought he was a different person because he didn't have his mustache. And I remembered that. And I thought, that's why you lost your mustache from the chemo treatments. And so for me, my dad's mustache is a symbolism of him being healthy and cancer-free. So for all those people that want my dad to shave his mustache, it's not going to happen.
It just strikes me so odd. You go back and read this stuff. You go, this is not real. This is just not real. You are listening to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, always available online at HallieKasserJane.com. My guest today, Kim Goldman, author of Can't Forgive. So talk to me about this. So you write this new book, your autobiography, Can't Forgive. So writing a book, as your family did years ago, by the way, there was another book that you wrote. Could you just fade into the sunset? Is that possible? Or you had to write it? There was something that gave you power back by putting it on paper and writing.
I would say both. I mean, honestly, we did. My family and I wrote a book, His Name is Ron, years ago, right after the civil case ended. And then the If I Did It book came out a couple years later, and I wrote a little bit for that. But this was my story, and this was an opportunity for me to kind of stand up on my own two feet and to step outside of always being Ron's little sister and Fred's daughter and now my son's mom. And I lost a huge part of my independence, and my own journey, like I said earlier, was kind of stalled. And this was an opportunity for me to kind of reclaim my voice and find me in all of this and own it. And I'm really proud of who I have emerged from all of my traumas as. And I get to be a great role model for my kid and for myself and for the job that I do and for other advocates. And it was the right time. I don't know how to explain it.
It felt
strong, and I got to control the message finally for the first time in 20 some odd years. And that was important to me.
Empowering. You begin the book with an extraordinary story of encountering Simpson in a parking lot and you contemplating running him down with your car, but you didn't. Why?
Because I'm not a killer. And because I knew that in that moment that running him over with my car would solve the immediate pain that I may have been feeling, but would have caused a long-term pain that I didn't want to put on myself or on my dad. And, you know, I'm not a killer. I have morbid thoughts. I can't lie. And there was that moment where I could have, and I revved the engine and I thought, oh my God, no one knows it's me in this parking lot and no one, it's just us here. And I remember revving and white knuckling, you know, my fist against the steering wheel and thinking I could totally take him out. And I just, it's not who I am. And I couldn't even contemplate putting my father through any more trauma than he had already been dealing with.
But you know, it begs the question that if you entertain the thought, even just for a second, does it open up to you the fine line that stands between a person who commits murder and one who gains control over their angry impulse? I mean, if you think of it that way, you weren't going to do it. Wow.
I mean, definitely. They're definitely, you know, but I think that fine line shows up everywhere in our life. The fine line between, do I need to have one more beer before I get in my car? The fine line between, is this the right person for me to be making a commitment to versus being a toxic relationship? I mean, I think we always have to question where we are when it comes to making big decisions. And yes, in that particular moment, was there a fine line between me having rage and emotion and morbidity in my brain between that and acting on it? Yeah, but again, I don't have the propensity to commit crime, to to harm anybody. I joked about it in the book, but like, I don't, the only insect I'll squish is an ant. Other than that, I shoo flies out of my house. I scoot spiders to the ledge so that they can go run free. I just am not that girl. And so it may be a fine line, but I didn't waver for too long. I mean, it was like a fleeting moment. And then like everything else in my life, I think of the big picture. I know what I need to do. I know I'm responsible. I know I'm a smart cookie, and I don't linger too long.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me just because I've been around, I've interviewed killers along the way. They're bizarre. I mean, they are bizarre, and we're going to talk about that kind of thing in a second. But you know what? It's hard to understand where they go. And for a second, you know, you made me stop and think to myself, there is that line. Anybody can cross it.
Yeah, but here's the difference between the killer in this situation, and I can't speak for all of them, though. This was premeditated. He didn't just go there and get pissed and then, you know, find the nearest weapon and kill her in a moment of rage. It was intentional. So there wasn't a fine line for him. It was like that is part of his makeup. You know, he was a violent human being long before he walked onto the steps of Bundy that night.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, you know, I can't speak for the woman that in the heat of the moment when her husband, you know, she walked
right
in on her husband cheating on that when someone snaps. Absolutely. That's a totally different scenario than a premeditated killing. He didn't just shoot Nicole. He stabbed her to death. He stabbed my brother. It was ongoing. It was like, it was a crime of passion, like you said, and that's not
right.
It's not in the heat of the moment.
Right, right, right. Clear. But I think that it's good to go down that road. It just opens up. In this conversation, I'm all about wanting people to see it from the other side for once.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's been properly done. In all the interviews I've ever heard of you talk, I think people failed to get your perspective in a true and honest way. And I think that's a mistake. I think it's a huge mistake because you are the victim of this. Ron's dead. He was the victim, but you're here. And when a victim is a survivor, and we're going to talk about survivor guilt in a minute, I think that is so important to bring that out to the world to understand.
Yeah.
I think that's what the trial failed to do for you, talking about survivor's guilt. It's a horrible feeling, I'm sure. It's bizarre. It's whoever even thinks that you're going to survive, right? Something like this.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I've really struggled with that term for me as it relates, because I think the survivor's guilt for me, and I don't know that it showed up in the book, you know, defined way, like someone who, you know, the people from Newtown, for example, you know, if there were students that survived that shooting, I think, you know, that to me is the true definition of survivor's guilt, that you were able to escape death. I think for me here, the survivor's guilt, the way I interpret it for me is that I felt for a very long time tremendous guilt for living my life.
Yeah, that's the kind I'm talking about, yeah.
Finding joy and I honestly remember driving in my car and singing out loud and thinking, oh my God, I shouldn't be enjoying this music,
right?
Because my brother and I were both singing at the top of our lungs, always in the car, rocking out. And after my brother died, I shut down. Nothing was happening. And then I remember the day that I started singing in the car and thinking, oh my, what does this mean if I'm singing now? Does that mean I'm enjoying my life and I shouldn't be enjoying my life because I have trauma and I have tragedy and I shouldn't be feeling good things? And that was where it got very confusing for me. You know, when I surpassed my brother's age, that was really hard for me because I was now older than him, and finding successes in my life that my brother wasn't able to realize on his own, that was really hard for me. Having a family, getting married, getting divorced, birthing a child, like all of those things.
He never would have,
He was never, and it does come with guilt, and not, it's hard to define it because it's not like I don't think I'm deserving of it. It's just I'm living a life that my brother never gets to have, and I feel regret. I feel resentment. It doesn't diminish the joy I feel around it, but it's bittersweet.
Right, it's bittersweet. But the other side to that maybe could be, I live it for myself and I live it for him. And every success for me is a success for him.
Yeah, because you know, the truth is I could have given up. I mean, the times that I had contemplated suicide,
right.
I mean, I just was like, I can't live this life. I was exhausted, you know, mentally and physically. And, you know, I dropped a ton of weight and I wasn't sleeping and I left my job. I left my boyfriend. I left my house.
You're traumatized.
I was in front of the camera. Like, and I was 22, you know, and I was exhausted and I just didn't want to deal anymore. And I definitely had moments where I thought I could just drive right into this wall here and that would be easy, or, you know, driving over the cliff and that'd be I had those moments, and I'm very, obviously very grateful and thankful that I didn't. And I know better, but.
And so you live it for yourself, and you can also live it for him in a way. I'm watching that clock, and I have so much to get to. So, you went back to court. No, sorry. I'm loving every time.
No.
Are you kidding? I'm loving. Not only am I loving this, I feel like I'm talking to an old friend. You're really, you're charming. You went back to court in the civil trial, and you won the judgment against Simpson for wrongful death. You guys ever get any money out of that, or did he bury it all?
We received less than 1%. That judgment is now well over $40 million with interest, and we've recovered less than 1% of it. So yes, he was able to hide all of his assets, and he is highly protected from certain laws down in Florida,
right. Which
is a very debtor-friendly state. His pensions are all protected, and now that he's in jail, he's not really earning much.
Right. And then let me take it out a little. And then there was his book, which you also got cleverly went after, and whatever proceeds would be yours. But let me ask you this. Justin and Sydney, his kids, who are grown now, but nevertheless, they're victims too. How do you feel about that when you grab a little bit of that to stop Simpson?
You know, for a very long time, my dad and I were incredibly sensitive to Justin and Sydney because they were collateral damage, of course. And, you know, I couldn't ever have imagined what their life would be like with their mother gone and their killer. Yeah, their dad is, I couldn't even put myself in their situation. And my father and I were always very sensitive with the decisions that we made and the avenues we chose not to go down to pursue the judgment because we didn't want to negatively impact his then kids. As we got a little older and learned a little bit more about how the judgment process works and collections and hiding assets, and when the book came about, we learned that Justin and Sydney were beneficiaries to numerous companies, shell companies, that were established to hide assets from us. And the book, namely, Justin and Sydney were shareholders in that book and the profits from those books, and they signed off on the book being published, and it was a big family meeting. Everyone knew what was going on. Everyone knew what the book was going to be about, and the kids signed off on it, and they were quarter owners of a company that stood to make millions off of that book. So once we learned that,
it shifted
a little bit of my attention. Not that I want to bring harm to them, but I need to look out for me, and I need to look out for my dad and our legacy and our family and do what's right for us. And I don't want to cause harm to them, but I didn't write the book.
Right,
so,
right.
If anyone's going to be pissed at causing harm to them, it's their father.
Okay. He finally lands in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sentenced, 33 years for robbery and kidnapping, eligible for parole after serving 9 years. Some argue that he wouldn't have gotten a jail sentence like that if it weren't for the trial. And does that matter to you or anybody?
Nope.
Yep. I had to ask it, though. You know I did, darling.
I don't care one bit. And, you know, again, that's where I get to reserve the right to be illogical. I don't care.
Here's
the deal. At the end of the day, she, the judge, didn't do anything outside of her authority as a judge. Did she give him the maximum sentence? Sure.
Yeah.
But she didn't do more than what she was allowed to give him. So, you know, if you don't commit 13 counts of crime, then you don't suffer 13 counts of punishment.
Right. So you, character that you are. You send him a note. You send him a card when he goes to prison.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny. I wrote about it. I didn't think that was I did. When the killer went, one of the things that always was hard for my dad and I is we never got to speak our piece. You know, for the criminal case, we never got to have a victim's impact statement. The civil case, you know, we both walked out the same doors as he did. It felt undone. And when he was sentenced and sent off to Lovelock Prison in Las
what
Vegas,
a name, by the way.
I did.
Yeah.
I went to the, yes.
I said the name Lovelock Prison.
Oh, Lovelock.
So,
yeah.
That
oh, sorry.
So funny.
I purchased a card that was congratulations on your new home. And I signed it. Welcome to your new digs. Love the Goldman family. Or I don't think I said love. I just signed it the Goldman family.
It's so funny.
Yeah.
You also wanted to have a conversation with him.
I did. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know that I fully contemplated how that was going to play out. Should I have been given the opportunity to speak to him? But I had this crazy idea that I wanted to see him behind bars. I wanted to see him in shackles and behind glass and being ushered through doors with bailiffs attached to him. It was important for me to have a visual of him kind of being diminished in size because he had taken up so much space in my life and in my brain, and I needed to make him smaller so that I could make him a little bit more manageable in my life. And seeing him in that place, I think, would have helped me do that.
What would you have said to him?
I didn't get the opportunity, but
what would you have said?
It wasn't about talking, honestly. I don't know that I had that worked out because it wasn't about that for me, because nothing I was going to say would ever penetrate him. I mean, he's a narcissist and he hates me, and there's nothing. What am I going to get mad that he killed? I mean, there's really nothing I could say that I hadn't said in a headline or in a newscast somewhere over the last, 18 years, whatever it was. It was for me. It wasn't for him. It was me being able to be the one to walk away and leave him behind, because I had always watched the back of his head every time he left a room, and he got to walk away a free person. I wanted to be the one to get to walk away a free person. And that was really powerful for me. He left my brother for dead. My brother was found with his eyes open, which means that he watched his killer walk away. And I've never been able to shake that image from my brain, and I wanted to be the one to walk away.
You amaze me. I want to talk to you about this. You also spoke to his attorney, Yale Gallanter. Is that I never knew.
Gallanter. Uh-huh.
And he attempted to set some compromising terms if you were going to get to see Simpson in jail. You want to talk just a quick about that?
Yeah, he wanted me to sign a confidentiality agreement that if I were to get myself inside the prison, that I would have to deny that we ever met. I could never speak of it. I could never talk about it to anybody. And if I were to ever tell anybody that I went, that he would file charges against me. And that, so I wasn't willing to.
He has to be something else, this attorney. He's not getting paid, right?
Well, In hindsight, I think that he, looking at our conversation,
yeah.
And again, I wrote about it. I mean, he said, I can't protect you in there. He's not a nice guy. If he tells you, he didn't say if. He said, when he tells you that he killed Ron and Nicole, then you're going to go out and you're going to tell 2020 and you're going to tell Oprah. And I can't do anything about that. And I think that's with his concern.
I understand that. I question if you're not getting paid and he's not court appointed, right?
Why? He was still his attorney of record at that point.
Right, I understand that. Why is he standing up for O.J. Simpson? That's all. He's not a court appointed attorney. He is.
I don't trust Yale Gallanter, and I think that he was looking for his own angle, and
right.
I think he was worried of what his client would say to me.
Oh yeah, no, but I'm not talking about it in terms of that. I'm talking about it the big picture. Who is defending O.J. Simpson? Why? That's my point. Why?
You see people walk on the street, there's always somebody for somebody. Everybody deserves to have an attorney, and the killer walks with a certain ilk, and Yale Gallanter,
paid. He's not, blah, blah, blah.
Well, the money that the killer owed all of his attorneys that he never paid came out of the proceeds.
Oh, it did. Oh, okay.
So all
okay.
Those people that weren't getting
okay.
paid,
so
they
there
put
was,
their
right.
bills into the kitty.
Okay. All right. Okay.
They all got paid.
All right.
Yeah.
Then I understand it. But if he wasn't, I didn't understand it. So listen, Kim, the title of your book, Can't Forgive. Now listen to me, my friend. Forgiveness. Biblical. Old Testament. Blah, 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 blah. You know the deal.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So spiritual leaders say, if you hold on to hate, it doesn't hurt them. It hurts you. You got to find the place within yourself to forgive. I'm curious as to hell how you got to that. By the way, and Oprah is even a proponent of closure, letting go. More of a term that I think people understand with closure. Talk to me how you got here.
I don't understand the concept of letting go. I don't know how you let go of sadness that's in your life. For me, other people, great. As it relates to me, I've just learned how to manage it. And I have learned how to not let my grief and my emotions suffocate me and to prohibit me in any way of living a healthy life. I don't know how to explain that. It's a conscious choice. It's every day it's choosing to live my life with honor and integrity and love and compassion. I've lived a life of I'm a nonprofit for the last 15 years of my life. I mean, I, w- I, I don't know how to do it any differently than the way I'm doing it. I know that when I look at myself in the mirror, that I'm not filled with hate, that I'm not filled with a dark hurt the way that people like to think of me. I have tremendous compassion and tremendous love, and I have targeted anger towards the person that slaughtered my brother. I think that's appropriate, and I'm totally fine with those feelings. And that's the best I can explain. I'm not a spiritual person. I'm not a Bible reading person. I'm Jewish. We don't believe in forgiveness the way that Christians and Catholics do. We just have a different perception, but I don't follow that. It doesn't work for me. So I forgive myself for not forgiving, and that's how I'm going to look at it.
It's not a judgment. I'm just taking it from the angle that needs to be taken at here. So if you don't, all the anger, all the hate, all the negative feelings that you have towards this one, towards the killer. Mm-hmm. So where are they? Do they rest in a certain part of your soul, and every once in a while they bubble out, or is it always there on a kind of low level? That's always there, or is it buried until you talk to somebody like me?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think there are different times. You know, I mean, do I walk around throughout my day and thinking, you know, that every time I see a white Bronco, I think of him? I mean, I don't know. I'm not aware of where it sits. I just know it doesn't sit in my mouth all day long so that I have a sharp tongue. I know that it doesn't sit and take up the entire capacity of my heart so that I can't love and feel warmth towards other people. I just know it's somewhere in me where it needs to be, and I think it's appropriate. What he did is unforgivable, and I don't think I need to do any more work trying to figure out how I need to forgive somebody for something I don't. I just feel like that's a wasted energy for me. The energy that I'd rather spend on myself is making sure that I get up every day with a smile on my face and with purpose and with honor and integrity and grace so that my son continues to live in a life like that. And that's the best way for me. And other people feel differently, but that works for me.
No, that's fine. You have a son, 11 years old, Sam.
Yeah, yeah.
Who does he look like?
When he was littler, he looked like his dad. I think as he's maturing, he's starting to take a little bit more of a Goldman look to him. He definitely reminds me of my brother. He's got the same freckle pattern, same brown eyes. He's got some mannerisms of my brother, which are trippy. But he's got my chin. But I don't think if you put us side by side, you'd think that we belong together. I don't know that you'd think that.
No.
We're very similar, though, in personality, so people know that we're cut from the same cloth, but I don't know. It's hard for me.
So what does he know of his Uncle Ron?
Everything.
Yeah.
He knows everything, yeah. Age appropriate. You know, my brother is a very big part of my life and always has been a big part of Sam's, but not until he was probably 5 or 6 did he start to really understand that what happened. And then as he got older, the stories got a little bit more detailed, and now, you know, it wasn't only until a couple of years ago did he even know who the killer was. He just knew he was a famous person. He didn't know much beyond that. But now he knows the name, and he knows that we don't pick number 32 when we're playing the lottery, and he knows that we don't root for USC because the killer used to play for USC. Those little things.
Yeah, little things. So
little things he's picked up on over the years.
I'm going to take this out one step with you on this, and that is, would you want to teach him forgiveness? If he gets mad at you, do you want him to learn how to forgive? I mean, and I'm just taking it out because that forgiveness thing is fascinating to me.
Well, I think forgiveness is appropriate when someone asks to be forgiven. And I think that's something that, you know, people forget here, that I absolutely want my son, and he currently is far more spiritual than I am. I want my son to live his life with giving people opportunities to be good humans, and for my son to be a good human and to make good choices and to be surrounded by people that honor you and respect you and build you up and are in your corner and in your team. I mean, those are basic life lessons that my son is fully embracing at this point. If somebody were to wrong him and do and harm him in a way, it depends on the situation. Of course, I want my son to be able to give people a second chance if they ask for it and deserving of it. I don't think that when someone commits double homicide that fits that same analogy. If someone were to lie to you or take your girlfriend or cheat on a test and blame you, like I just don't think we can put murder in the same category as other things that people do that may deserve forgiveness. It's not the same category for me.
20 years. That's unbelievable. Where did the time go, right? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You've been living this for 20 years. You've been fighting for Ron's legacy, and that's what this really is about. For as many years that you lived with Ron alive, as well as dead. I mean, it's right. So my question.
Yeah, I mean that's you know, for me, I think about it in those terms a lot. That I've, you know, most of my life has been living this, and I, you know, again, that kind of goes back to why I thought the book was important, because I am more than just the sister of a murder victim. And I think that when people have been traumatized and victimized, that you immediately, you know, handicap them by calling them a victim, because that renders you in a place of helplessness, and I think it can paralyze some people, but there is such growth and such beauty in overcoming and standing up strong and forward thinking. And, you know, we do continue to live a life. It's just different. It's a new normal. And we look through life in a different colored lens than we
had before.
Did seconds before.
Right. There's the before and the after. Would Ron want you to be out there just still fighting? Is that, do you think, did he have the same fight that you had?
I hope this doesn't sound insensitive. I don't have the faintest idea what my brother would say, because we would never have had a conversation about what the other one should do if one of us gets murdered. So my brother and I were always big believers in advocating for right and wrong, and for sticking up for the little guy, and for staying true to our heart. And so if I am living my life that way, and I do that with the integrity that I think I'm doing it with, and I think my brother would be proud.
Simpson's up for parole next year, right?
Oh, is it already? Is it I think 2017.
Well,
is it 2017? I don't even remember.
It's scary to get him out there again, right?
Yeah, you know, it feels safe for me to have him behind bars, because he doesn't...
He can't hurt.
He doesn't... What?
He can't hurt you or anybody.
Well, it's not even the hurt. It's that he does things. I mean, even while he's in jail, he still, you know, gets his face plastered on the National Enquirer. But, you know, being behind bars, he limits his opportunity to get into my TV screen. So I like having him there, because it controls what I have to deal with out here. But who knows?
Who knows?
But the system has not always been kind to me. It's always very surprising. So we'll see.
Right. So if you had one more minute with Ron, just one more moment, what would you say to him, Kim? After all, he never did get to say goodbye.
I would probably tell him I was sorry for getting mad at him about not paying me back the money that he owed me, because I was really mad about that. But I think I would probably just thank him for being the second part of me, and for teaching me so much about living life to the fullest, and with a smile on my face, and with purpose, and for not always having to be perfect, and for finding strength in your faults. And I just think the lessons that he taught me before he was killed, and I don't know, they kind of manifested themselves a little bit more after he died.
I've been speaking with Kim Goldman, author of Can't Forgive. For more information on Kim and her work with the National Center for Victims' Rights, visit Kim at her website at kimgoldman.com. Hi, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. Did you enjoy the show? I hope so. And I hope that you'll tell your friends about it and help us grow our family. How can you help? That's easy. Share the link to the show with your friends or my show's player. And I would love it even more if you'd recommend they visit my website at HallieKasserJane.com. I look forward to seeing all of you there. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, a production of Resac LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieKasserJane.com.